Welcome to episode 145 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and joining me on the podcast is Pamela Wexler, who's The Fens, the third in her series about Abby Endicott, Boston's chief homicide prosecutor, was just published by Minotaur Books. Pam sets her most recent legal thriller in Boston's sports world, specifically the Boston Red Sox. And as anyone who has ever followed Major League Baseball knows, Boston takes its baseball team very seriously, and fans can be protective to the point of obstruction of justice. Here's Pamela Wexler. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and joining me today is Pamela Wexler, whose third Abby Endicott mystery, The Fens, was just published. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you very much.
Your main character, Abby Endicott, is complicated, to say the least. She doesn't have to toil in the public sector. She's wealthy. But she works as Boston's chief homicide prosecutor. And in fact, it's costing her because her wealthy family has cut her off. So why does she do it? And I should add, where does she come from in your imagination? So it's a two-part question.
So she's a woman who lives in two very different worlds. She's from a Boston Brahmin family. She grew up on Beacon Hill, which is a very wealthy, old money part of Boston. And she has chosen to spend her time in the life of an assistant district attorney dealing with tragedy and danger and other people's problems. So it's something that she doesn't have to do. She really could do anything. She's well-educated and well-connected, but this is where she spends her time.
And where did she come from in your imagination? How did she bubble up and ask you to create her, as it were?
I was a prosecutor for 17 years before I started writing. I started writing for television and then novels. So she sort of is a combination of a variety of people that I've met along the way, and including my own experiences, and then taken to a different place in my imagination to sort of an extreme. But having spent 17 years as a prosecutor, it was not that hard to imagine her.
Which is both comforting and frightening if you've read the book. Abby's relationship with her partner on the police force, on the Boston police force, Kevin Farnsworth, it seems straightforward. But I'm kind of in agreement with Ty, Abby's boyfriend. I feel undercurrents of attraction between them. And, you know, Kevin's described in the book as happily married. Am I letting my imagination get away with me?
No, you are not. I think there's an undercurrent there that comes from spending so much time together, getting to know each other so well under really difficult circumstances, and then there's a physical attraction. So I think there's an emotional attraction, and there's a physical attraction that a spouse or a boyfriend can't really compete with, even though they have never taken it to another level.
Your book, The Fens, is sports-related, and sports in Boston, I was just in Boston last week, sports in Boston is transcendent, and by that I mean it's one of the few things that can bring a city that remains divided into distinct racial and ethnic tribes together. Did you feel that having sports figures, Boston Red Sox players at that, involved in a murder investigation might just be a third rail for readers, especially those in Boston?
Well, the book, Boston is really a character in the books. And each of the books deals with something that I find interesting and unique about Boston. Politics being one of them, colleges and universities being another, and then there's sports. So people have very strong opinions about sports in Boston, but everybody is interested in it. So I used it as sort of a backdrop for the mystery. It's not really about the Red Sox. It's more imagining if a player for the Red Sox became the victim of a crime, what would happen and how it would divide people?
Well, it would divide people and it would polarize people, which I guess is sort of the same thing. And it would, someone that high profile, and in this case it is a pitcher and catchers that are involved. Catchers are dying and pitchers are suspected. Could cause pressure from all kinds of sports is big business. And like any big business, pressure can be brought to bear on the police, on the district attorney, on media. So that's one of the reasons I find it an interesting direction to take a crime.
Right. Well, it's sort of the idea for me of celebrity. And when a celebrity is either a victim or on trial, or, you know, both, I find that interesting in how it impacts the location, how it impacts a jury, how it impacts an investigation. And it can really be in any industry. You know, I live in Los Angeles now, so it could be the entertainment industry. But in Boston, the celebrity are the athletes or the politicians, really. So that's why I chose the Red Sox.
And I, first of all, I should mention that I am a sucker for mysteries that have a backdrop of sports. That's just one of my quirks. And I'm actually surprised that more crime fiction novels aren't set in the world of professional sports. I think it's fertile ground. There are highly competitive young men, lots and lots of money, team owners that always seem to have an agenda, and of course, you know, fans who range from mild to maniacal. And you know, you mentioned the juries, and there's a jury in your book, and it becomes voir dire, becomes very interesting for both the prosecution and the defense, because you know, sports figures are idolized, as you said. They're celebrities. They walk on water. They can do no wrong. How can they possibly be accused of crime?
Right. And how do you get a juror to convict them of a crime, which is the challenge of the prosecutor? You know, once the books are sort of divided in two parts. The first is who did it, and the second is how are we going to get them convicted? So that is the challenge in the second half of the book, is how are we going to get a jury of Bostonians to convict the star pitcher on the Red Sox?
And you bring in all kinds of interesting, actually fascinating sort of legal right turns and left turns. You have a girlfriend who becomes a wife and decides she's going to claim spousal privilege. You've got one of the victims is actually related through marriage to the person on trial. How hard was it to keep all of these relationships in your head as you were writing this mystery?
It unraveled as I was writing it, so it wasn't. I was sort of following where it took me. So it wasn't sort of a big picture having to keep them all. I just would go down different paths with them and see what would be interesting for each character in the book to do, what obstacle they could present, and how the protagonist could get around that obstacle.
And Abby certainly has her work cut out for her, because it seems that every time she goes down an avenue that she's going to use to prosecute, something happens.
Right.
And that's, you know,
that's what I find interesting about writing legal thrillers, because in real life, in trials, things happen that you don't expect. And you really have to adjust very quickly and figure out what your next move is going to be. You can be prepared and you can be in control, but then something comes your way and you have to deal with it, particularly when you're dealing with witnesses and victims who have emotional ties to different aspects of a case.
And of course, Abby is a brilliant prosecutor. and she brings it all to court. But when she's outside of the courtroom, she's a little bit of a hot mess.
Yeah, she's kind of a mess. Yes, I would agree with that.
And
she spends so much time fixing other people's problems, possibly as an escape to having to deal with her own, that she just lets things build up in her personal life.
And why? What exactly do her parents have against her being in the prosecutor's office? Why are they so adamantly opposed to it, to the point where they have cut her off from her family trust? She's had to move in with her boyfriend. She can't buy all the wonderful clothes she wants to buy. She's down to her last pair of Louboutins.
Well, I think it's a really valid reason, which is it's a really dangerous job. And in the first book, in Mission Hill, they learned, and Abby learned, just how dangerous it is when one of her colleagues was murdered. So that was what set her parents off and why they're not retreating from their position.
Yeah, but her parents seem, I have to say, her parents seem a little bit aloof. And I might, if I was the family counselor of this tribe, I might say they might just be doing this to control her as much as they are concerned with their safety. Her mother doesn't seem to be terribly engaged.
Well, they're not warm and fuzzy people, but she still has a close relationship with them. Abby's mother didn't approve of her job to begin with before someone was murdered in her office. Abby's mother thought it was sort of beneath her and she could do better in her mind, something more befitting her in a big firm or a bank or something. But then when this incident happened, that's where they drew the line. And that's where the father jumped in and the brother jumped in.
And yet she has I thought the relationship with her brother and her sister-in-law were really wonderful. I mean, he might disapprove of what she does for a living, but he seems very involved in her life and willing to have her be godmother to their child.
Right. I mean, it's just like any familial relationship. People don't particularly agree with decisions that we all make, but they can still provide love and support for the person. And that's what I tried to bring out in the relationship with Abby and her brother.
And, of course, in the book, her mother is a very, very interesting character study. And I really saw where Abby might have inherited some of her strategic thinking from her mother.
Yes.
But I don't want to say anything because that would be a spoiler.
Okay.
Let's talk about Pam Wexler for a second, though. You mentioned this in the answer to one of the questions. Your career is a study in contrasts. You were a rock star prosecutor in Boston and a trial attorney for the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., something we're learning a lot about right now.
Right.
And is your switch of careers a case of, you know, what I really wanted to do was write mysteries as well as be a writer, producer, and technical advisor to TV. And what did your parents say when you told them you were going to Hollywood?
Well, it was not something I planned. I was a prosecutor for a long time, as you said. And when you're a prosecutor, the longer you're a prosecutor, the more limited your options are. So you can either spend your entire career there, you can go on to be a defense attorney, or you can become a judge. You know, once you're sort of 10 years into doing it, your options are limited. And I really didn't want to do either of those. I knew I was done being a prosecutor. I didn't know what I was going to do next. But along the way, someone who was a television writer, I knew nothing about the world of television, contacted me about one of the cases that I had prosecuted. He was like a friend of a friend, and he was writing for a TV show. And we started talking, and through that, I became aware of this whole other world out in Hollywood, and ultimately started writing spec scripts of my own and submitting them. And I got an agent and got a job on one of the Law and Orders. And to answer your question about my family, when I was living in Washington at the time, working for the Justice Department, and the offer came very quickly, and I had to respond very quickly. So I went in and I quit my job and I packed up my apartment and told everyone I was moving to Hollywood, and they all thought I was nuts for a variety of reasons, not least of which was the job security is non-existent here. So I came to work on a show, Law and Order Trial by Jury, that lasted, I think it was 13 episodes, and then it was canceled. And, you know, after leaving this career, and, you know, with that I was on a certain track, I was essentially out of a job. The show was canceled. Now what am I going to do? So it's a lot of scrambling and hustling and keeping working, even when you're established. So I sort of built from there. But it was a big leap, and it was a big change, and I'm really glad I did it.
I think this is sort of inspiring on a number of levels. One, that, you know, the impression is that writing for Hollywood is only for people that are 25 and younger. Not that I'm saying you're old, but if you've been a prosecutor for 17 years, you're not 12.
Right.
And you're a woman. So I give you a lot of credit for doing that. It is crazy out here. I also live in Los Angeles. I know a number of screenwriters. I'm the only writer I know that isn't writing a screenplay. But you must have been interested in writing. My partner, Les Klinger, in the podcast, is an attorney, and he's always saying that lawyers do a lot of writing. They write briefs. They have to communicate ideas in a succinct and convincing manner when they submit briefs to the court. So had you been interested in writing before you took this huge leap?
Well, I've always been interested in storytelling. And I think prosecutors in particular are creating, it's factual, but it is still a piece of theater that you are choreographing when you do a trial. And you are presenting your side of the story to a group of people. So I've always, that is something that I felt comfortable doing and enjoyed doing. I was a photojournalist when I got out of college. So that's another form of storytelling that I was interested in. And my mother was a writer. She wrote book reviews for the local newspapers, but which is also a different kind of writing. So I've always sort of been around and interested in the idea of storytelling, and this was a really cool way to combine those two things. I loved being a prosecutor, and this way I could draw from that experience and take it to a different place.
And then you decided to go to sort of long form and write novels, which is very different from screenplays. I've talked to a lot of writers who have done both, and screenplays tend to end up being a collaborative sort of framework process. And a novel is very, very personal. You know, it's just you and the keyboard.
That's right. It's a very different experience, and it's a different craft. You know, they're both crafts, and you have to learn, or at least I did, to get a framework for what I was going to do. And it actually came about in a sort of roundabout way. I had moved back to Boston. I had spent 7 years in Los Angeles, mostly writing for the Law and Orders, and then I moved back to Boston for 2 years for some family reasons, and went back to the DA's office for 2 years. So I went back into the courtroom. And I was consulting still on some projects, one of which was a movie called The Judge that was being filmed in Boston. It was starring Robert Duvall and Robert Downey Jr. and Billy Bob Thornton played the role of the prosecutor. And he and I spent a lot of time talking about various experiences that I've had. And he, who, you know, was an Academy Award-winning writer, suggested that I write a novel, drawing from those experiences. And so I quit my job in the DA's office again and went to this place in Boston called Grub Street, which is sort of the community for writers there, for mostly novelists, and took some workshops and wrote a first draft of Mission Hill and then sent it out to agents. So that's how I got into writing the novel, and then eventually started writing for television again, and that brought me back to Los Angeles.
Well, like, you know, if Billy Bob Thornton tells you to write a novel, that works for me. If he told me to write a novel, I think I'd do it.
Right. I mean, you kind of have to go for it. If there's a good idea, then why not? So, yes, that's what I did.
Well, and you know, I love that this is, you know, all these leap in the dark kind of stories. I think it's a kind of an amazing track, and I like that you kept a foot in both worlds. When you went back to Boston, you went back to your old stomping ground in the prosecutor's office, but you also kept a hand in your world in Hollywood. And Hollywood, I mean by virtual Hollywood, you know, filming everywhere.
Right. So it's tough, though. I have to say, once you leave to get back in, it's tough.
It was tougher to get in the first place.
It was tougher to get back in.
It was. Interesting. I guess they don't like it if you leave.
Well, they don't like it if you leave. And, you know, the shiny new thing is always sort of stands out more. And it worked out, so...
So you're writing a series. I guess that's my other question, because my next question was going to be what's next for Abby Endicott. But before that, I think I want to ask you, did you know when you wrote the first book that it would be a series? Or did you conceive of the novel as a standalone, and then when it was shopped around to publishers, they said, oh, we really like it, but we want this to be a series?
Well, when I wrote it, I hoped that it would be a series, and I wrote it so that it could be a series. And when it was shopped around and I was offered a 3-book deal, you know, I thought that was really exciting. So it wasn't something I felt confident about or set out to do, but I had definitely had it in the back of my mind that it could, you know, to write something that could be a series.
And The Fens is your third novel, so is there going to be a fourth Abby Endicott novel?
Well, I'm not sure yet. I'm writing for a television show right now called Bull, and we're about to gear up for season 3. So that's where my focus is right now. But The Fens was left open again so that there could be and might be a fourth one. I just haven't decided yet.
Well, thank you, Pam, for joining us and talking about the Fens and talking about your career, your multifaceted career. And I appreciate your time, and I appreciate you talking about Abby Endicott and prosecutors and Hollywood and all, and Billy Bob Thornton.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.